Hello there and good evening. First off, big thanks to the two Johnnies for plenty of entertainment this afternoon. It is Thursday, the 13th of April. I'm Shane Dawson and you are listening to Game On. Coming up over the course of the next hour, David Connolly and Rebecca Cray chat association football as Chelsea lick their wounds after Madrid. Manchester United look for goals in Europe without Marcus Rashford, and Vera Pau plots her squad choices after the USA doubleheader. In rugby, Bernard Jackman looks ahead at a decisive weekend in the URC and the Women's Six Nations. While in boxing, we'll hear how a new governing body might salvage the Sports Olympics status. As always, if you want to get in touch, you can text us on 51552 or tweet at GameOn2FM.
Game On on 2FM.
Now, all of that to come very, very shortly. But first, profoundly sad news that broke today. Waterford Rally driver Craig Breen has died in a crash this morning. The news was confirmed by his Hyundai Motorsport team today. Breen was participating in a pre-test event ahead of Croatia Rally when the incident happened at approximately 11 a.m. Irish time. His co-driver, James Fulton, was unharmed. Hyundai Motorsport sends its sincerest condolences to Craig's family, friends and his many fans, a statement read. Breen had rejoined Hyundai for the new World Rally Championship season, having spent a year with the M Sport Ford World Rally Team. The 33-year-old finished second to Altanac at Rally Sweden in February in his first WRC start of the season. On Twitter, the World Rally Championship said, "The WRC family is shocked and saddened to learn of Craig Breen's passing. Our thoughts and condolences are with the family and friends of Craig at this incredibly sad time." Motorsport Ireland said that Breen never forgot his Irish roots and was continually affording opportunities to those wishing to pursue a career in rallying. Motorsport Ireland president Aidan Harper said the Irish motorsport community is numbed by this tragic news. Craig was a world-class driver and a world-class person. To Craig's family, his parents Ray and Jackie, his sister Kelly, brother-in-law Dara and nephew Bobby, I wish to extend my deepest condolences and all our thoughts remain with Craig's co-driver James Fulton. May they all find the strength and support they need at this unimaginably tragic time. FAI President Mohammed bin Salim also paid tribute. On behalf of the FIA, I extend sincere condolences to the family and friends of Craig Breen following his passing during a private testing accident. Our thoughts and prayers are with his loved ones and the rally community at this difficult time. Formula One said the Formula One community is sending our thoughts and love to Craig Breen's family and friends. So we are now joined by John Kenny from RT Sport, who has extensively covered the sport both home and abroad for many, many years. But first, let's hear from a 2020 interview Craig Breen did here in the Game On studio after Hyundai signed him for a World Rally Championship drive in Sweden.
Yeah, it's a big step. It's a really big step towards my future. And the fact that the team have put their confidence in us again going forward, definitely, you know, it gives me a lot of confidence. And, you know, I really think that if we can get a good result in Sweden and any other opportunities, any other rallies that they will give us throughout the year, I think we can get back onto this thing full-time again. And that's, I want to be a world champion, you know. There's never been a world rally champion from Ireland. There's never been a rally driver from Ireland that's ever been on the podium. So I've ticked a lot of the things off the bucket list. I've been forced to do a lot of them, but obviously I would very, very dearly like to be a world champion, as I think any aspiring athlete, you know, in their sport would like to do.
So what do you need to do to achieve that dream?
It's a very complicated and sometimes corrupt way to make it up the ladder. You know what I mean? Like I was saying before, I can't go into the garden and practice. You know, it's not as if, you know, at school age I can go out in the back and, you know, and practice and get better. I was very, very fortunate that, first of all, I had a family that was willing to support me up to a certain extent through karting and whatever else. And I've had a lot of sponsors and backers and from, you know, Irish companies, Irish people to, you know, far and abroad people have you know, pushed me and got me up to where I am. I won a lot of different scholarships. Until I was 11, I won the junior World Rally Championship. It was €500,000 prize money. It evaporated very quickly, let it be known. It got me onto the next season. Until I was 12, I was world champion in WRC2, which is the step below the main WRC. I got a contract with Peugeot, done a couple of years in European Championship, got a contract with Citroën, done a couple of years in the World Championship, and I've just been kind of leapfrogging, and you're surviving every year. You know, every Christmas and New Year's is a bit daunting, unless you've got a two-year, two- or three-year contract. But when you're at the end of your contract, you're just grasping at every straw that you can, trying to get the next year going. So it's a tough sport. Mentally, it's an extremely, extremely tough sport because your whole world can stop very quickly.
You yourself had to deal with some tragedy in the past. Your friend passed away before. How did you deal with that?
Yeah, that was tough. You know, I was only a young lad then, 22 years of age. And I had the same co-driver from day one of my rallying career, Gareth Roberts, little Welshman. Little by every sense of the word, he was tiny. But we were doing a rally in Sicily around the European Championship and doing quite well. And unfortunately, we left the road and the barriers, the AMCO barrier system in Sicily was quite outdated. And unfortunately, Gareth was killed immediately. So tough for young lad and very much young, head on young shoulders at that point. You know, this whole rallying world was just all about, you know, driving fast cars and, you know, living dreams and whatnot. And suddenly it was a big, big reality check. So, but look, I had a lot of very, very nice people around me. You know, my family first and foremost, a lot of close friends. And I got back into rally car within, you know, I think it was 10 days or a fortnight. I got back and managed to win what would have been the second world title that same year then. So, I know no different. You know, I remember the night that the accident happened, you know, obviously grieving deeply for losing my absolute best friend, but grieving, I won't say equally as much, but seriously grieving for losing my sport, because I thought it was common practice that, you know, something that happens, you know, you have to stop. And I remember, you know, talking to my dad on the phone that night and saying, you know, I don't, as much as I'm devastated for losing Garrett, I can't believe I've lost what my whole life is directed, you know, was directed to at this point. And he's, you know, that's you don't have to stop, you know, it's not as if society will presume that that's the next natural step. So at that point I decided, no, I can't stop this. I don't know anything different. I can't go and work in an office. You know, I'll drive the thing into the ground if I'm let loose at something like that. You know, my passion and my dream and everything about me is driving a rally car. So,
and I'm sure that's what he would have wanted as well.
Yeah, absolutely. That's what he wanted. He wanted to go to the top as well. And I just thought, you know, the best way to push both of our dreams on is to, you know, get back on the bandwagon and have a go at it. And we're still here, you know what I mean, nearly 10 years later. So it's not often that kids get to really live their dreams. You know, kids are young age, they want to do something, they set their eyes on something, you know, astronauts or firemen or whatever it is. I never for one second wanted anything else or anything different. So to have the chance to be at the absolute pinnacle of what you've wanted to do since you were a child, it's something that you have to be, you know, incredibly thankful for. And you know, a lot of the people get lost in the whole world, get lost in the whole professional side of it and sport side of it and competitive side of it. But sometimes you have to come out of the bubble and go, wow, like this is, you know, there's computer games, there's kids at home playing this on a computer game and, you know, someone's paying you a salary to go and do it. It's really, really incredible. And it's something that I'm very, very proud of.
That was Craig Breen speaking to Marie Crowe here in the Game On studio in 2020 and speaking so elegantly, and he always spoke so perfect, even when on media duty, whatever the occasion was. As I mentioned, John Kenny joins us now. And John, tragic news that many people across motorsport are still coming to terms with. You would have gotten to know Craig over the years and I suppose are very well placed to perhaps tell us the sort of character that Craig Breen was.
It's quite open in that interview with Marie there. He'd be quite guarded a lot of the other times. He was racing in, don't forget, in only one of two manufacturers in the World Championship, which are Toyota and Hyundai. The other one's a semi-work sport team, that is M Sport Ford, which he raced last year. It didn't work out for him. He had a great result in Monte Carlo, finished in third place, and then the season kind of unravelled. So he was back with Hyundai this season, having been with them on a part-time basis about 3 years ago. He's been, as he said, to-ing and fro-ing a lot of the times over his career, but that's just the nature of the beast, I suppose, in that circumstances, because there's so few drives and it's difficult to retain one. But he got another eight drives this year around eight drives along with Danny Sordo, the Spanish driver. This was his second one, coming up in Rally Croatia, having finished second to Otanic in his opening round in Sweden. So things were gearing up nicely. James Fulton, obviously, is his new co-driver. We must actually say our condolences particularly to Paul Nagel and to James as well. But Paul Nagel was his previous co-driver, and he'll be absolutely devastated. I sent a message to Paul. Obviously, he hasn't returned a call or anything today, but saying, I can't get my head around this. And I would say at this stage, neither could Paul, but Paul Nagel.
I think many people can't really get their head around this. It was such shocking news that reached us this morning and around lunchtime. Racing was in the family when it came to Craig Breen, with following in his father's footsteps as well, John.
Yeah, Ray Breen, national rally champion. Craig started karting first, and then went rallying, but he was actually a co-driver for a couple of years before. In 2006 he took over, 2008 I should say, he took over rallying. Since then he's got multiple awards. He won two junior world championships. 1 year, 2019, he had no drive at all, so he decided to compete in the Irish Tarmac Rally Championship, and boy were they glad to see him, because there was a championship that was on a bit of a wane. As soon as Craig came back, the place was absolutely buzzing. People came out from nowhere to try and beat him. They couldn't. He blitzed the whole season and won the championship. But the championship has grown ever since then because of his involvement. He turned up with the likes of the Killarney Rally of the Lakes, and would drive last year in particular. He drove Frank Mara's old Sierra Cosworth, a beautiful car, sight to behold it was. And he even dressed in the same manner. His suit, boiler suit or racing suit, was exactly the same as Frank Mara's. And they actually hit something, broke glass, and his jacket flew out the window, and all he was concerned about was getting Frank's jacket back, because he was so devastated about the loss. Eventually he did, but that showed the kind of character he is. He was a driver that dreamed of driving in the World Championship when he was a kid. There's some amazing shots of him watching Frank Marr, the late Frank Marr, compete down the years as a kid standing on the side of the road. And he had no interest in football, rugby, soccer, tennis, you name it. All he wanted to do was drive a car. So a fan, an anorak, became a World Rally Championship driver. Sadly, we'll see no more of him.
He was hugely respected and equally as popular, it seems, a figure on the circuit, John.
Yeah, that's one thing. He brought that kind of Irish positivity and the, as they call it, the crack with him. And he would surround himself with a lot of Irish people. No, not that he would surround himself. They would surround him. They'd go to his tent, and there was cups of coffee and biscuits and tea and always being thrown out. He always wanted a cup of tea. First thing he did, as soon as he got into service, cup of tea, cup of tea, cup of tea. And that's all he really wanted, to get himself back together again. We'd do a couple of interviews with him and send him on his merry way. Nobody would bother him. They'd say, hi, how are you? They know exactly, Irish motorsport fraternity, the rallying people in particular, just how dangerous a sport this is and how it's proved to be. And sadly, with the loss of Craig Breen today, but they'll be devastated. We're all devastated by this. Craig Breen won't now get the chance to win a World Rally Championship round, or indeed his lifelong dream to be a world champion.
I know there's a lot of tributes pouring in, and understandably so, and one of the quotes was, whenever he got the chance, Craig still continued to compete at local events in Ireland and in recent months support younger drivers. Earlier this year, a sponsorship deal was announced that would see him directly supporting the Junior 1000 category within the Sligo Pallets Forest Rally Championship. And as recently as last Tuesday, he attended a J1000 tuition day where 18 young drivers got to meet and learn from their hero. I mean, that sums up the humble nature of Craig and the fact he was a supreme role model.
He was, yeah, for young rally drivers. And then credit to Motorsport Ireland as well. They've set up a Motorsport Ireland Academy for which young rally drivers and co-drivers, and indeed male and female and circuit racers, can get involved in programs of fitness and things like that. That wasn't there in Craig's day. Craig, though, did win the Billy Coleman Award for the Young Rally Driver of the Year. So he was bringing something back into the sport, but they were kind of just an aside. That's the kind of things he would do anyway, and he didn't really talk about it. He just went off and did it. Didn't make any big deal of it. His main priority really was sitting behind the wheel of a car and trying to win a world championship round. A couple of second places, a couple of thirds as well. But sadly, that elusive win, well, it's not going to happen now, is it?
No, unfortunately not. An extremely sad news, as I mentioned there. John Kenny, thank you very much for taking the call and to discuss the career and life of Craig Breen. Craig certainly was a model competitor and I suppose no greater advocate for Irish motorsport. Our thoughts and condolences go to all of Craig's friends and family and everyone in the sport, of course. Lots more still to come on this evening's show. Stay right with us. We'll be back after this.
Game on. Boxing.
Now, you're very welcome back to Game On as we turn our attention to boxing. And a new international governing body has been established in amateur boxing in response to ongoing issues within the International Boxing Association. The new organisation, named World Boxing, is backed by Olympic boxing powerhouses such as the United States and Britain. RT Sports' Gary Moran spoke to Matthew Holt, chief executive of GB Boxing and a member of the interim board of the newly founded World Boxing.
Game On.
Boxing.
I suppose just briefly explain to us when you started to formulate these plans and how you've got to today.
Well, it's been a long process. It's been a long process, hasn't it? IBA was suspended by the international by the IOC in 2019, and there were concerns raised about finance, about governance, about sporting integrity, and The status of the sport since that day has been on life support as it regards the Olympic program. The status of the sport as part of the Olympic Games is absolutely fundamental to the future of the sport. It doesn't just impact the boxers on the podium with the gold medal around the necks. It impacts every layer of the sport, from the grassroots through to regional, national competition, Commonwealth Games, World Championships. So it was our determination that we had to do everything to protect the status of the sport on the Olympics and protect the hopes and dreams of all the boxers that walked into gyms across the United Kingdom, across Ireland, and across every other boxing gym in the rest of the world. So our motivation has always been to make sure that we're acting in the best interest of the boxers. And unless we protect that Olympic dream for the boxers, we're not doing everything we can for all the boys and girls and the women, men and women that have got aspirations in our sport.
Well, to protect that Olympic dream, you'll need to be recognised by the IOC, which hasn't happened yet. Have you had any discussions with them?
No, this is not being about a conversation directly with the IOC. We're doing this for the sport of boxing because we believe it's the right thing to do, that we want to change the future and build confidence and trust in the sport looking ahead. We want a sport that is well regarded, not just by those participating, the boxers, the coaches, the officials. We want to have a good reputation amongst the media. We want there to be confidence in results on the field of play. And of course, we want there to be confidence amongst the Olympic movement as well. So, of course, this is a process, and this is the beginning of the process. We've engaged in the first phase of that, in building a really strong organisation that is underpinned by world-leading statutes as they pertain to an international sporting federation, a whole host of policies and procedures that protect the integrity of the sport, and then new initiatives by building in as much as we possibly can into the life of the organisation, third-party oversight, which will be evident on the field of play and outside the field of play. So in time, we'll have those discussions. We will seek that recognition, and we're confident that we've got the infrastructure and the foundations that are solid enough for that to be achieved in the long term.
So you'll be aware, I'm sure, that boxing is Ireland's most successful Olympic sport by quite a distance. Boxing in Paris, you will not at that point have had be affiliated, I guess, with the IOC. You expect it to go ahead, though, under an IOC-managed process, but this new World Boxing Organization will have nothing to do with it, will they?
I've enjoyed watching so many great Irish boxers over the years. I was the team manager for Team GB at the London 2012 Olympic Games, and I'll never forget the bout between Katie Taylor and Natasha Jonas, which I still remember as the loudest event of the entire London 2012 Olympic Games. So I'm kind of, you know, I've been immersed in the rich tradition of boxing in Ireland since I've been working in the sport, and long may that continue. More talented boxers coming through now, which is fantastic. But moving on to your question, our expectation is, of course, that the boxing is going to be at Paris. The IOC have committed to that. The qualification process is about to begin at the European Games for our nations at the end of June and July. And we're very fortunate that the Olympic movement has decided that it wants the sport in the Games to the extent that it's prepared to organise the Olympic Games and the Olympic qualification process itself. This is unheard of. And I think that demonstrates, you know, how important the sport is. It's accessible. It's competed By all continents. There are boxers from, you know, kind of from high rises in Liverpool to low rises in Johannesburg. It's a truly international, sport, and it's a truly global sport for men and women. So it's a really important component sport of the Olympic program. But we don't take its presence on the Olympic program for granted. And this is very, very important. There are lots of sports that are chomping at the bit to become Olympic sports because they know what it means for the growth, for the development, for the opportunity that it presents. And we absolutely don't take that for granted, even though the sport meets lots of markers which are important to the Olympic movement. We have to build a sport that people and the Olympic Games has confidence in, fair competition, well-run, efficient. We need to be more commercially driven. We need to deliver great tournaments. And most importantly, we need to deliver the sport in a way that it takes care of the welfare and the best interests of the boxers. And it'll be that secures the status of the sport in the Olympic Games in the long term. We're confident we can do that. We've got the infrastructure. And now we need to be trusted to go on and do that.
Yeah, but as it stands, it's not on the preliminary list of sports for LA 28. So if world boxing is going to be effectively the governing body for a substantial number of countries, you've got no members yet, and you need to get members at a sufficient level to become heavily involved in 28. Is that a realistic ambition?
Well, Gary, it's a great question, and clearly there's lots of work to be done. You know, we've gone through phase one of organisational development, and the second phase is to generate as much membership as we possibly can and to build confidence amongst our boxing colleagues in national federations across the world. And we believe that by securing a future on the Olympic programme, by delivering well, by acting as a great organisation that has the capacity to deliver to the highest standard for its athletes, we can make that case persuasive both to the national federations and to the Olympic movement. And of course, that process of recognition will take time. The process of building membership will take time, but it'll be the quality of what we do that will help deliver that in the medium and the long term.
When will it be a significant event, the kind of event you're talking about that broadcasters would be interested in?
Okay, so we're expected to host an event by the end of 2023, and then a more coordinated competition calendar will be developed for 2024 as well. Of course, 2024 is a busy year. It's a busy year for the boxers. It'd be the same for your high performance unit in Ireland. It's very much the case for our boxers that train in Sheffield as well. We've got European Games coming up, and we've got two Olympic qualification events at the beginning of 2024 as well. So you'd expect me to say to you that all our kind of preparation and all our focus is preparing the athletes in a way that they are absolutely kind of primed to peak at those Olympic qualification events, because that is absolutely our bread and butter. And we won't be doing anything other than to create opportunities that best prepare the athletes for those events.
Game on.
Boxing.
Well, very interesting times ahead for boxing. So it will be interesting to see what comes of that very interesting interview there. Gary Moran speaking to Matthew Holt. Lots to come still on the show. We're going to be chatting soccer with David Connolly and Rebecca Cray. And conveniently enough, actually, two of David Connolly's former clubs are in action at the moment. Feyenoord are hosting Roma in the Europa League. It is nil all there. And West Ham are in Belgium. They are taking on Ghent. And I was going to report on West Ham taking the lead. A goalkeeper howler, Davy Roof, dropped a very simple catch and it ricocheted in off a West Ham defender. However, after a VAR review, it was ruled out for a handball. So Ghent and their goalkeeper, Davy Roof, off the hook there. David Moyes looked very displeased on the TV coverage. So we will be keeping you up to date on that. But up next, we're going to be chatting rugby with Bernard Jackman, and we'll hear from Irish women's head coach, Greg McWilliams.
Game on.
Rugby.
Now, the head coach of the Ireland women's rugby team, Greg McWilliams, has announced his starting 15 for Saturday's Six Nations game against Italy and Parma. The team shows three changes from the defeat by France: fullback Lauren Delaney, centre Anna McGann and Ailsa Hughes at scrum half, all coming into the starting 15. Today's team naming came against the backdrop of an article in the Telegraph newspaper which laid a number of accusations at the door of the IRFU. McWilliams says he doesn't believe the Irish Rugby Football Union is a sexist organisation and said the article contained a number of historical issues.
I read the article. I think it'd be wrong of me to not read the article. And lots of it's historic. You know, it's the same things that you could have talked about last year when I met David Nusafora in 2021. I started on the 1st of December. He outlined a plan and everything that we talked about, we're on track. And that's all we can focus on. You know, I was the only full-time staff member on the 1st of December. We now have 7 full-time staff members. We have 8 contractors that come into us for our competition week. We have 8 new employments along our pathway and our centres of excellence. So, like, there's been a massive growth in that time. And to be honest with you, talking about things historically is we can't control, and we can't control the external noise. We can control what we can do. And it's a good lesson. It's a really good lesson for these young players, not just in rugby, but in life, that if you trust in the process of what you're doing and you've got good people around you, I've been really impressed with their resilience I've been impressed with their ability to rise to the challenge of playing Italy. What happened previously, you know, I can't stop people talking about it. And if anything, that's something that they can talk about all they like. We've got to focus on Italy, and we've got to focus then after Italy, we've got to focus on England, and after England, we've got to focus on Scotland. We have to get better. The Irish public, you know, demand good performances. They've seen that with the men's and the 20 side, and even the under-18s girls' sides were phenomenal last weekend. Things are happening here. And as a head coach, I absolutely believe in the plan and the direction we're going in, and so do the players. And that's what's really exciting. This is a challenge for us. It's challenging our growth as a group. It's challenging our ability to stay focused. And the reaction has been superb. And I've been really proud and impressed by how they're dealing with that. And it's... Yeah, it's an interesting article, but again, you know, it's nearly irrelevant at this stage. We're moving forward and we've got a great plan and we've got good resources around us.
So Bernard Jackman, Greg McWilliams and the Irish team are moving forward, and the next test for them, as I mentioned, is Italy in Parma at 4:45 on Saturday. Just on the match itself, considering all of this outside noise, considering the start to their Six Nations campaign, how difficult will it be for the group just to pick themselves up and get ready for this tough, tough test?
Yeah, I think the timing, obviously 48 hours before they play Italy is unfortunate. I think we're all aware it's a very young squad, and I just hope that they can, I suppose, try and get a performance, because that's what's, you know, the things right in front of their face at the moment is trying to get that first win in the competition this year. Italy on form probably look, you know, a team that we should be scared of. They've been very competitive in their two games. Scotland are probably the ones that you know, we probably feel that we have the best chance of winning and avoiding a wooden spoon, but it would be a huge boost for this group to get a win this week away in Italy. And yeah, it's going to be very difficult for them, because there isn't a huge difference to, I suppose, concentrate on the task at hand, which is obviously try and get a performance and a result on Saturday.
Absolutely no unforced errors, and they will have to be switched on for the whole match, unlike the Ghent defence, who have just conceded a goal to West Ham in the Conference League. Just to keep our listeners updated, it is 1-0 to West Ham. West Ham took a quick throw in while two Ghent defenders were celebrating a bit of good defending. The ball was crossed in and Danny Ings slotted home into an empty net, pretty much. So West Ham leading 1-0 approaching half time in Belgium. It is half time between Feyenoord and Roma in the Europa League. West Ham, of course, in the Conference League. Bernard, let us chat URC, because now we did discuss this. Well, Marie did discuss with Michael Corcoran yesterday as well, for anyone that was listening yesterday. Andy McGeady has a great article on the URC website, I must say, with all the permutations ahead of the last two rounds. Because the state of play really is 16 rounds of the United Rugby Championship have gone, two to go, and a huge amount in the melting pot. 13 of the 16 teams entered the final fortnight trying to secure their URC playoff position and or a spot in the Champions Cup next year. There are scenarios aplenty. It could be tricky and complicated. There will yet to be twists and turns to end this long season, with some perhaps to come even after Week 18's results are in the history books. Now, there is plenty of permutations. I know you tweeted out a lovely graphic from the URC as well, about what is needed for all the teams really that are still in contention, everyone except really Edinburgh Dragons and Zebre. Leinster leading the way. We've talked at length of Leinster and how good they are. I do want to pick your brain on a couple of contract news with them very shortly, but first just on Ulster, because they're up tomorrow, and I suppose they're the next matchup. They have Dragons and then Edinburgh as well. No Rob Herring, Rob Balakoon injured is well. Dan McFarland has made six changes from the side, beaten by Leinster in the Champions Cup, with Herring and Balakoon out, as I mentioned. Rory Sutherland all listed as unavailable as well. So Craig Gilroy replaces Balakoon, joining Mike Lowry and Jacob Stockdale in the back three. It's an unchanged centre partnership of Stuart McCloskey and James Hume, while John Cooney, who last week agreed a new contract that Ulster, comes in for Nathan Doak at scrum half, starting inside Billy Burns. Will we see a big response here from Ulster? They're all but guaranteed really a playoff spot. They're playing for a home semi-final now.
Yeah, and look, what a card that is. I mean, Ravenhill, Ulster, and they have on paper a very simple task, to be honest. I know they're missing some big name players, but Ulster squad has a lot more depth in it than the Dragons. The Dragons are coming off a 70-point defeat away to Glasgow. I don't think they've won in a 10 or 11 games. So low on confidence. Ross Moriarty left last week to join Breve, even though his contract wasn't up to the end of the season. They released him early because it guaranteed him his future. So Welsh rugby is still readjusting to this, salary cuts and lack of stability. And the Dragons probably are the team, least equipped to deal with that. And you would expect Dan McFarland's team to go out and get a bonus point and build some confidence, build some momentum for the playoffs ahead. And obviously, if they can guarantee a home draw, you'll feel that's going to be massive for them. It's hard to see them being able to go on the road and get the job done. So they really need home advantage.
I do want to pick your brain before we chat contract news just on Munster as well, because they're in South Africa, and well, going into this weekend, they really need to come away from Cape Town with some sort of result. A win would make week 18 very interesting, while even a draw or a close loss, I suppose, helps Munster to avoid very bad things happening when it comes to their Champions Cup prospects, because it's nearly, I don't know, for traditional rugby fans, it's nearly unfathomable to think of Munster playing in a Challenge Cup as opposed to a Champions Cup. But it might happen, Bernard.
Yeah, and look, this was the talk, when they had such a bad start to the season, that if they don't pick up quickly, they would run the risk of not being the Champions Cup, which would be disastrous for Munster. And the after effects of that could take a while, in terms of revenue, in terms of players maybe not wanting to come there to play Challenge Cup, because there is a huge difference and there's a huge lure to the Heineken Cup. And obviously Munster played such a prominent part in the history of the competition. So I think they need 2 points over the last two games. That should be enough. So two losing bonus points or a draw should sneak them in. That's because I don't think Connacht will win away to Glasgow. But you just don't want to be relying on that. You want to get a win as quickly as possible. They were got blown away. In fairness, it's a very strong Sharks team on paper, and they pulled out a big performance, which, to be honest, they've struggled with this year to be consistent. But what we saw against Munster was a Sharks team where all their internationals were switched on and they played with a huge amount of pace and power, and Munster couldn't live with it. So the Stormers are coming off the back of a very poor performance away to Exeter, which is so unlike them. They're usually so consistent. So unfortunately, Munster, you sense, is going to be a bit of a backlash. And with some of the injuries they have in the front row, or players unavailable, you just fear for them. You're up against the front row with Matt Herb and Kitchoff, the two Springboks. It could be quite a difficult afternoon for them, and then they'd be going into the Sharks, trying to get a win in a place that they'd been blown away just a couple of weeks beforehand. So this is going to be a real test of character. I think that Roundtree and Leamy and Prendergast have done a good job. I think they're lacking maybe a little bit of talent, a little bit of power, particularly up front, particularly front row. So it's going to be very, very nervous times for Munster, and I just think and hope they can sneak into the Champions Cup for next year, because that would have a big effect on I suppose the mood, the confidence, and you know also revenue. You know, this time next year, if they've played in the Challenge Cup, I think it's going to have a big effect on their bottom line.
Well, it certainly is a super Saturday of live rugby on RTE this weekend. Lions Leinster 3 p.m, Stormers Munster 5:15, and Connacht Cardiff Blues 7:35, all live on the box. Leinster announced some contract news in the last half hour. Ronan Kelleher has signed a new deal with the province, and a little bit earlier, just before we came on air, James Lowe was the latest Ireland international to agree a new contract at Leinster, with the winger committing his future to the province. The 30-year-old follows James Ryan and Josh van der Fleer in signing new contracts to stay at Leinster. Interestingly, Bernard, and this is what I want to pick your brain on, James Lowe's deal is funded by Leinster rather than his central contract with the IRFU. Are you surprised by that?
Yeah, I think so. I think so because of the importance he now has for Leinster, or for Leinster and Ireland. He's a guaranteed starter for Ireland at the moment. He adds so much to our game. So you would have thought he should have been in line for a central contract, but there's no real rhyme or reason to those central contracts. It's taken Josh van der Fleer a long time to get one. He got one last week. It's all coming out of the same pot, really, at the end of the day. So it doesn't necessarily mean that he can't be paid what he's worth. And I'm sure he is being, and he deserves to be. But it's just the actual name on it. And also, to be honest, in the Irish system, it doesn't really matter in terms of game time control or anything like that. You know, Andy Farrell can make a phone call, or the medical team from Ireland can make a phone call, and, you know, his minutes will be monitored because they have that control. Whereas in Wales or in Scotland, it is really important. Well, Scotland less so, in Wales particularly, it was really important to have a central contract. So the likes of Alan Wynne-Jones, etc., the fact he was on a central contract meant that Warren Gatlin could pull him out of certain games for the Ospreys if he felt he was getting too much game time. Whereas in Ireland, it just really means that Leinster are paying for it. But at the end of the day, it all kind of ties back to the RFU anyway. And I just think Sheen and Lowe signing up again, I think when you look at Leinster, they haven't had a regretted loss since Johnny Sexton. I don't think there's any player that they, you know, they would have wanted to keep Joey Carberry, but obviously he wasn't number one. But apart from Sexton going to Racing, whatever it is, 5 or 6 years ago, Leinster pretty much kept everybody that they want to keep, which is, you know, really, really good news for them that everyone wants to stay.
Absolutely. Bernie Jackman, thank you very much for taking the call. Big weekend of rugby. Just a final bit of contract news. Adam Byrne and Conor Fitzgerald are among 8 players who will depart Connacht at the end of the season. The province announced their final list of departing players today, having previously confirmed Kieran Marmion's move to Bristol Bears, as well as the retirements of Shane Delahunt and Alex Wooten. 5 additional players will be leaving the sports ground at the end of the campaign, with Byrne and Fitzgerald the notable names on that list. Leva Fafita, Sean Masterson, Kieran Boot will move on from Connacht, with director of rugby Andy Friend, who's also leaving at the end of the season, along with 2 of his coaching staff. So we'll be interested to see what lies ahead for those players, particularly Adam Byrne, former Ireland international, of course, as well. Okay, lots to come. We're chatting soccer with David Connolly and Rebecca Crane a few moments' time. Stick with us here in Game On 2FM.
Game On.
Football.
Now, you're very welcome back to the final part of Game On. Former Ireland international David Connolly is on the line, and Rebecca Cray is sitting across from me as well. Thank you all for your patience and sitting around until the final part. We've left the best to last, sure. Some breaking news for Manchester United fans. The starting 11 is in for their game against Sevilla tonight in the Europa League. The team is David De Gea, Martinez, Fernandez, Martial, Malacias, Sabitzer, Casemiro, Varane, Anthony, Sancho, Wan-Bissaka. I'll let you make out the formation yourself. That is in numerical order. But before we look ahead, David, let us look back at Chelsea's defeat to Real Madrid. I suppose they were lucky in the sense they only come away with a 2-goal loss. But having said that, they did have some of their chances of their own. Is 2-0 a fair reflection of the game, in your opinion?
Yeah, good evening. I mean, probably, I'd say. You know, look, the way Real Madrid started, you thought, goodness me, this is going to be, this could be a cricket score here, you know, because they came flying out of the traps. They were so sharp, moving the ball so quickly. And then just a couple of times, Chelsea had a few counterattacks, and you thought, oh, hang on a minute, you know, this might work out a little bit differently here, you know. Kante, I thought, was brilliant, you know, for them. You've always got a chance. But, I mean, the wide men for Real are just so quick. I thought they were just outstanding. They couldn't contain them. they couldn't contain the two wide men per row, and they were just such a threat all game. They were brilliant.
Absolutely, and I think that's what led to Ben Chilwell sending off, who has since come out and apologised for his mistake. A lot of Chelsea fans are blaming Mark Cucurella as well for his positioning. I mean, who was at fault there, David?
Well, it's tough because I think Mark Cucurella, I think he's hampered a little bit because, you know, I've been at Stamford Bridge a few times, and if Ben Chilwell's not starting, you know, say he's warming up down the pitch, the crowd are cheering for him to come on. Like, they like him. You know, they really do like him. And if there's a toss-up between the two, you know, they obviously much prefer Ben Chilwell. I think Cucurella's yet to win him over. And obviously it didn't help yesterday. Comes on after Koulibaly pulling his hamstring. Follows in Rodrigo, who is so quick. I mean, I don't think you can follow someone so fast in if you haven't got the same pace or more pace, you know. And he span him, done him. Chilwell comes round on the cover, and look, he'll have nightmares about that, because I've done similar things and bitterly regretted it, getting sent. I got sent off for Ireland doing something stupid, you know. So
you're a striker though, you get away with it.
I didn't get away with it, let me tell you. And rightly so, because, you know, to be honest, like you're there and you're going, why, what did I do, you know, moment of madness, and you regret it. Now look, whether the game would have been any different, I doubt, but you know, they would have had obviously that extra man for the next half hour, and credit to him for apologising. But obviously, you know, it was just a moment of madness. But he was put in that position. You know, you got that split second to decide, right? What do you do? Do you stay with the runner, knowing that you're probably not going to catch him, or, you know, you do something silly? And he done, you know, I guess it was stupid. I mean, if it was in the box, it would be even worse, right? Because it would have led to a penalty. But I'm not too sure the result would be much different anyway, to be honest.
I don't know, I'm championing the union. Go up the goalkeeper's union. Trust Kepa. Would have been grand. Just let him through, get the shot away. Kepa would have saved it. You'd be grand.
Maybe. You might be right on that. You know, you might be right, exactly.
Who knows? Rebecca, that is 13 defeats in Frank Lampard's last 16 matches as manager in all competitions across spells with Everton and Chelsea. However, he believes Chelsea can produce a special night and overturn that 2-0 deficit when they welcome Real Madrid to Stamford Bridge next Tuesday. Would you share his optimism, or is it a bit deluded?
You have to commend him for the faith he has in the team, but I don't think the Chelsea that he's dealing with now are the Chelsea that he may be been a part of back in the Mourinho days. You know, they don't seem to have the same kind of bite about them, you know, that they look like they were going through the motions parts of the game yesterday. Look, Real Madrid to me are just next level. You know, sitting there watching my dad, and he's like, they're just like a well-oiled machine. Mm. You know, they know where each other are without even looking. Luka Modric, he's just world-class. He tore them apart. And I think Kante was probably the standout player for them, but I think it's going to take a miracle for them to do anything at Stamford Bridge.
Absolutely. I wholeheartedly agree. Let us look forward to this evening's match. It is still nil-all in the David Connolly matches, I suppose. Feyenoord and Roma nil-all. West Ham are leading Ghent 1-0 as well, as I mentioned earlier, two of your former clubs, David. But Manchester United, so we have the team news in there. Obviously, Casemiro back is a huge positive for Manchester United. No Marcus Rashford, though, as well. Yeah. Like, how big a loss will that be? And do they have the players that will stand up now?
Well, is when you read out the team news, I was trying to keep up. Is Martial starting?
My team news back up, he is indeed. Yes, thank you, Rebecca. So I read it out numerically, but yeah, like Martial, Anthony, Sancho are all starting, so that would be the attackers, if you will.
Yeah, I mean, I guess, look, they're probably lucky that Martial come back. He's fit to fill in for Marcus Rashford. Now he's out, and, you know, got a goal the other day. You know, he was bright. I think Erik ten Hag was always going to play him, but you could tell that by how he was sort of trying to give him a lot of praise the other day, saying, you know, whenever he plays, he has an impact. He doesn't need many minutes to score goals. You know, all the usual stuff when you're trying to build someone up, knowing that basically you're going to put him in the team. And no surprise he's in. I guess Varane from Maguire maybe was one that you thought, well, we might play Maguire. Maguire's won a lot of the games, but no surprise really Varane's in. And yeah, Casemiro coming back in is huge for them. But, you know, when he's been out, they've, what, 1-3,
lost one, and McTominay scored. Sabitz has been an influence. So it just shows they're certainly a lot stronger, you know, than they were. And, you know, I think that'll bode well for the weekend, you know, because I think Newcastle got Villa. That's a tough game, you know, whereas United have got Forest. And you just think, well, I'll tell you what, if they get off a good result tonight, going into that Forest game, Newcastle have got Villa, you know, that table could look a lot healthier, and it might just all start tonight.
Manchester United boss Erling Haag has said his side play their best football when Anthony Martial is playing. And I suppose that's when Anthony Martial is actually interested in playing David. You know, I don't know if that's a bit harsh on him, but it is a case of he's a talented footballer, but he has to be switched on.
I mean, look, there's no doubt that what's his options down through the middle? Weghorst is not the you know, a number nine in the sense that he's got the pace to run away from anyone. So he plays Weghorst as a 10 at times, but he's, you know, and he's done okay at that, like an attacking 8 or 10. But he's certainly down through the middle. He needs pace down through the middle, and Martial gives you that when he's fit. But he's had a very disruptive season. But whether he's the long-term answer, I don't know. The good thing, I think, for that front three from the other day, Sancho was involved in a goal. Martial, you know, got a goal. And, you know, look, it wasn't Anthony's greatest game. But, you know, I think those two will get a lot of confidence from that. Ironically, I think the front three of Man United are probably the three biggest confidence players you've probably ever come across. So I don't know what Becker thinks. But they, you know, they seem like they absolutely thrive or not on the confidence. And I think without Rashford, yeah, you know, the goals against Everton, yeah, we'll give them a bit of a boost for tonight. And this is not the Sevilla of old, right? You know, this is not the Sevilla. They're sort of mid-table. They've got a couple of Enneseri, Ocampo. They've got a couple of players. But really, United, like they did to Betis, should be putting them away, I think, comfortably.
Should be. Will be interesting to see if they do. That one kicks off at 8 p.m. David Connolly, thank you as always. Rebecca, you're staying around because let us chat international football and look back and reflect on an aggregate 3-0 defeat across two friendlies away in America. But results aside, for the Irish women's national team, are there more positives to take from the performances than negatives?
Yeah, most definitely. I think looking at the games, I don't think we fared too bad at all. I think we saw a different style of play as well that Vera has been, you know, trying to bring into the squad and you know, trying to attack that wing back position more so and get an out and out number nine in Caruso to hold up the play, you know. And look, watching over the two games, I feel a lot more confident now than I did maybe, you know, before they started, just due to the pure and simple fact that they just went for it, you know, at times. And I don't think we've seen that from the Irish team. We're quite a defensive unit. You know, there obviously was times in the qualifying campaigns where we got those goals that we most definitely needed at the time. But yeah, I'm definitely more positive, let's say.
That's good.
For this period of time anyway.
For now.
We still have France to come.
Yeah, exactly. That will be a test as well, and Zambia as well before the World Cup. Who stood out for you in terms of people who caught your eye?
Yeah, like I think there was a lot of talk about Sinead Farrelly before the games kicked off, and I think she stood up to the, you know, the chat that was going on about her. She just brought that kind of level of calm and composure that an experienced footballer does. Obviously she's been out of the game, what, 8 years, is it? 6+ anyway.
Yeah, she retired in late 2016, and she only recently came out of retirement. And she's 33 years of age,
exactly,
you know, as well. So,
yeah,
she has that experience, but adapting back into.
Exactly. And, like, to me, she didn't look like someone that was out of the game that long. Albeit, look, I know the likes of the American footballers tend to have that certain level of fitness, you know, they, I don't know what it is, they're feeding them over there, you know, but she done really well for me. Again, you always revert back to the McCabe and O'Sullivan link up. Look, they just have that telepathic understanding with each other. And I think, you know, we spoke before here, before we went on air about just wrapping the two of them up now for the next few months in bubble wrap. And I think that's what we're going to have to do. Again, paying out right wide. I think she's much better attacking those wings. She loves to play there, get the balls into the box. And it's just trying to find that number nine now. Whether that be Caruso, you know, obviously we've Barrett there on the bench as well. And I think Caruso did really well. She linked up and held the ball up, allowing others then around her to kind of get on the ball and you know, try and work something, gone into the box.
Good stuff. Well, lots to look forward to as well. And Australia firing a bit of a warning shot to Ireland, ending England's 30-game unbeaten run with a 2-0 friendly victory over the Lionesses at Brentford as well. So plenty to look forward to. Briefly, Rebecca, we are bit stuck for time, but there is a full billing in the League of Ireland Women's Premier Division after the international break. Let us just quickfire give us a few predictions, I suppose. Shelburne versus Treaty United, 2 p.m. in Tulka Park. How's that one going to go?
I think we're going to go for Shell's win.
I suspected you might.
I'm not being biased.
No, that is fair. Table doesn't lie. Deal or Waves versus Sligo Rovers. Sligo Rovers looking for their first points. Will they get them?
I don't know. I might see a draw there, but I'd love to see them get a few points on the board.
Okay, 5 o'clock then. Cork City against P-Mount United. P-Mount United, top of the table, probably going to continue that good form.
Has to be P-Mount for the win there, yeah.
Tough to call this one, I'd imagine. 5 o'clock, Galway United and Shamrock Rovers.
Exactly. It's going to be very interesting to see how Rovers travel. Galway, a very, very tough outfit. You know, got some good results under their belt so far. Again, I don't know if I can call that one.
Galway win. Okay. Yeah. Unsettled Shamrock Rovers. And finally, in a word, Wexford Utes or Athlone Town?
Wexford.
That kicks off at 7:35. Bohemians are idle. Rebecca, apologies for rushing you. Yeah, Sinead.